Today's episode of the Film Stage Roundtable is brought to you by Mubi, the curated streaming online cinema. For your free trial, go to mubi.com/filmstage.
Try to see it my way. Do I have to keep on talking till I can go on? While you see it your way, run a risk of knowing that our love may soon be gone. We can work it out. We can work it out.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to a brand new episode of the Film Stage Roundtable. This is the spin-off podcast of the Film Stage Show. During these episodes, rather than reviewing a film in depth, we will be tackling a broad range of discussion topics related to the whole of film culture. Who is we? It is we. First, we have Bill Graham.
Woo!
Yeah, and then we have Michael Snydell.
Hello, I'm here again.
Woo!
And then we have me,
just
Brian
one
Nero.
Name.
And... I know. We're gonna try to cut our times down by half by just having me settle on one name each time for Mike Bull Snydell. So, before we begin, we want to extend an invitation to everyone out there to let us know what kind of things you want to hear more about. If there's a particular bit of film news that you want us to get our take on, if you have a specific thing in the world of cinema that you are super excited about or just want to know our opinions on, all you got to do is find us on the social media. You can reach out on Twitter at Film Stage Show. You can find us on the Facebook at The Film Stage Show. And if you really want to lay into us, you can email us podcast@thefilmstage.com. We also really value your subscriptions and your comments and your ratings on iTunes. That helps people find us because we deserve to be found because we're awesome. I don't think I'm alone in that.
No comment.
All right. That's fine. Good for you, you contrary bastard.
You're only creating this shit.
Okay. Well, I'd like to remind everyone that
I never got to tell you that my mom started listening to a podcast once, and she thought it took too long to get to the review and turned it off.
Serious? Which one?
Ours? Ours?
I think it was Pete's Dragon. I don't know.
That's crazy. But you're ours? On that one. You think that she'd do the mom thing and at least listen to it because you're on it. I guess now would be a good time to remind people that I actually go the extra mile in these. These are enhanced podcasts. There are chapters. You can use your chapter selection arrows to move ahead if you want to miss this classic banter.
Exactly.
I mean, to be fair, my mom learned about smileys in the last 6 months, so well, I don't know.
She's not even
who
up to
calls them smileys? Emojis?
I'm fine.
Emojis.
My mom's not on emojis. She's still on emoticons. Which one is fine. The wink? Is that the semicolon? All right, anyway. We are brought to you, as always, by Mubi. The streaming online cinema. Mubi has a rotating selection of 30 films. There's a new film every day, and you have 30 days to watch it. You can download it to your tablet, your iPhone, whatever, which makes it super awesome for those long car trips when you're stuck with people who you'd rather forget you know. I think that more than ever, my antipathy for the human race comes through during the Mubi plugs. Speaking of antipathy.
Is that the tagline right there?
Yeah, I think that's it. Mubi, soothe your antipathy for the human race. Mubi, what is wrong with us tonight? We're doing this a day later than we usually do, so I think we're off. Yeah. I think we're off. We're just loopy and crazy. So, Mubi's got some new films coming on. One of them should be interesting because, guys, we all hate hipsters, right?
Like I literally drink pumpkin spice lattes and have a handlebar mustache. So
Michael,
I don't know. I kind of like craft beer as well. So
yeah, I really like craft beer.
I was listening to vinyls today, but anyway, yep. Williamsburg, Brooklyn, is a hipster haven. But not long ago, it was a poor Latino neighborhood in seemingly out of the way Brooklyn. There is a doc on Mubi, Los Sures, and this is a newly and lovingly restored print of it by the New York Public Library and Union Docs. So you can find that on Mubi. Also, The Distance, which is This is awesome. Two Russian ghosts journeying back to life.
Ooh.
I don't feel like I need to say anything else. It's an amazing sounding movie. And you, I love three things in life: Russians, ghosts, and journeys. So this movie is right up my alley. So yeah, this is the great stuff you can see on Mubi that you're not going to find on your Netflixes and your Hulus. And you can get a free month trial now by going to mubi.com/filmstage. You know what's hilarious? I just realized I can't find the sound clip, but when this was Danny and Nick and I, Danny once brought up a film that he saw on Mubi, and it was so early in the existence of Mubi that he actually called it Mubi. And I wish, like Dubai, but with an M. And I wish I could find that, but I can't. But anyway, that's it. That's our 14-minute plug for Mubi. Let's get into our actual topics. Our first actually sort of piggybacks off of something that we had talked about a couple weeks ago, and that is remakes. We pitched our own, and now it's time to talk about ones that have actually already been made. So this topic's title is Great Remakes Other People Made. So that is a great cover version of Tainted Love by Soft Cell.
Oh, I thought you were going to play the Marilyn Manson version.
No. But no, I mean, that is a cover, but the original song isn't by Soft Cell.
Interesting.
Yeah. Do people not know that? I feel like that's like a party trick that I do. It's originally by Gloria Jones.
I did... Okay, I did think that they were the original creators of this.
Oh, Bill. All right, anyway, it doesn't matter. So that's Tainted Love, which is itself a remake, which is a great remake. And it is a remake that is actually, in some ways, obviously, Bill has shown us, subsumed the original. So we want to talk about great remakes. We've talked about shitty remakes. We've talked about movies we'd like to remake. We're going to talk about the good ones. Each of us has chosen one remake after we had to fight over who got to say the thing. So,
I said it first.
Okay, whatever. We've already been through this. So we are.
Am I in a sandbox right now? Come on.
All right. Anyway, so Bill Graham, let's start off with you. What is your choice for a fantastic remake?
So this one is kind of a little, it's a weird one that I didn't see a single person mention.
Wait, so are you actually not going to do the thing right now?
Yes.
Okay.
I thought we already discussed this. That's all right. This is 2012's Dread. It is towing that line of being maybe a reimagination of the source material, but let's be very honest.
We all argued a shit ton about.
Yes, but let's be very honest. When you hear Dread, a lot of people still think, oh, that stupid Sylvester Stallone movie. And this is why I chose it, because this is a movie that basically tries to wipe it off the face of the earth, right? It's like, no, that Judge Dredd bullshit with Rob Schneider and Sylvester Stallone, it should never have been made. I don't know how it exists. I guess it was kind of at the height, or not even the height, kind of at like the tail end of Stallone's like popularity. This was 1995, so I guess it was, I guess it was right around kind of their heyday. The Van Damme, the Schwarzenegger, the Stallone kind of heyday. But, man, that movie was such a piece of shit. And Dread, what it does is it basically takes the source material and it treats it with respect. And that's one of the reasons that I really love it. John Wagner and Carlos Esquera are the original creators of the Judge Dredd comic, and they gave Dredd this kind of mystique where he never removes his helmet in plain sight. And what is one of the first things that happens in the Judge Dredd film with Stallone is he removes his helmet, and people flip the fuck out because we got like 30 years of comics where you never see Judge Dredd's face. And within the first 10 minutes of the Judge Dredd with Stallone, his face is plainly visible, and people already are just like, I don't think you really understand like why we even like this character and why we even like this story. So in the Carl Urban version, he never removes his helmet in plain view. He does remove his helmet at one point, but all you see is just a silhouette of the back of his head. So you get away with that. But it really kind of treats it with respect. It has a lot of fun. And if I'm not mistaken, it actually adapts one of the stories, the Peachtree's location of the 2012 Judge Dredd is actually a storyline in the comics. So it even takes one of the storylines from the comics and basically adapts it onto the screen. I think beyond that, it is a fantastic film, much to Snydell's disagreement. I think this is a 90-minute, just brain-dead simple setup and execution. If you don't know,
brain dead.
If you don't
know, set me up for that one.
Yeah, I know. If you don't know the setup, basically, Olivia Thirlby is Anderson, and Judge Dredd is played by Carl Urban, and they arrive on the scene. They're trying to track down this drug that's new on the streets called Slow Mo, and they track it down into this giant. It's called Peach Trees, and it's this giant like. I don't know, block.
Yeah, it's a giant tower complex. Block city thing.
Yeah. And this is in kind of like the near future. It's like 2040 or something like that. And so basically they arrive on the scene, they try and track down the people that are creating this drug, and they find out that kind of the source is upstairs near the top of the block. Well, once they try and hold someone hostage to try and get some of that information out of them, Mama, who's basically the leader, the gang leader,
Cersei
Lena
Lannister.
She decides to just go ahead and put the place on lockdown and basically says, hey, you fucked up because you came into a place where there's a ton of criminals. And guess what? I'm just going to tell them, if you want free rent for life, just kill the Dredds. And that's it. And so, kill the judges, which is only one at this point. Olivia Thirlby is actually a rookie. She's been kind of thrown into the fire to sink or swim, basically. And Dredd has kind of like taken her along with him. And so that's the setup. And if it sounds eerily similar to The Raid, yes, congratulations. It does.
There have been so many interviews where Alex Garland, who wrote this movie, has been like, I swear to God, I saw the trailer for The Raid and my heart just broke.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Oh, no.
Yeah. Yeah,
this movie is great. Like, I went and saw it in the theaters because I was doing a podcast at the time where our listeners would vote on what they thought we were going to be the best and worst movies of the month. Mm-hmm. And it won worst. And then we went and saw it, like actually saw it. And it was fucking amazing.
I remember watching the trailer and feeling absolutely nothing for this film. I didn't want to see this. It showed up. I think it was either Fantastic Fest or South by Southwest. I'll have to kind of figure that out, but it was for one of those film festivals that I was down in Austin for, and I set up interviews with Carl Urban and Alex Garland, and so of course I went to go see the fucking movie, and I saw it, and we were at a press screening, and I guess it had screened at Comic-Con to like gangbuster applause, and people were like, what? wait, this looks like shit. And the trailers were terrible. So if you saw the trailer and you thought this doesn't look very good, don't worry. I was there with you. I thought it looked terrible. I was not sold on it. And then I saw the movie and I was like, wow, this. And the best part about this kind of remake is it actually got me interested in reading the comics itself.
Have you read the comics then?
Yeah, I've read a few. Yeah.
Are they good?
Yeah, they're actually pretty good. No,
you already mentioned that.
No, I didn't.
No, you were talking about how you knew it was based on a specific comic, and
I knew the background of it.
Okay.
Yeah, I didn't.
Way to make an assumption, Michael Snydell. Yeah, I would say I'm going to allow this only because, Bill, you made a very excellent point that to most people, Judge Dredd is that shitty Sylvester Stallone film, and this is indeed a far superior remake. And I actually signed one of those petitions that was like, we should get a remake made. Or not a remake, a sequel.
Sequel, yes. So, yes, this film definitely needs a sequel.
Yeah. But Michael Snydell, I know that you didn't like that movie, so we're going to just skip over that whole thing. And I want to hear what you're going to offer up to the group. What do you think is a superior or the best remake?
Oh, boy. Well, guys, I asked this question on Twitter, and people suggested things that probably would have been great if I could get around to them. Like, people suggested that I watch the original or the remake of Breathless. I really wanted to get to the remake of Paul Schrader's Cat People.
What about Homeward Bound? Did you get to that one?
I did not get to Homeward Bound either. So
you've never seen Homeward Bound?
Of course I've seen Homeward Bound, but I haven't seen the original.
Yeah, no.
But that was my rule. There's a lot of movies I love, but my rule when this thing came up is that I couldn't obviously do the remake if I hadn't seen the original.
Sure.
So if that wasn't the case, I would have done things like A Star is Born with Judy Garland and James Mason, The Fly, and Wes Craven's Last House on the Left.
Sure.
Kate Fear was one that I majorly wanted to do.
I've never actually seen the Thing, the original Thing.
Oh, really?
And that it's not actually called The Thing, is it? Or
it's the from thing another, from another world.
Another yeah. world, yeah.
Which is, both of them are based off the short story, Who Goes There? Mm-hmm. But
the original is Howard Hawks, I believe, as well.
What was that?
The original is director Howard Hawks, I believe.
Yes, I believe so.
All right. Well, so I didn't get to any of those. And I was going between two movies, and I picked the one that's probably worse. But let's do this.
Okay.
Whoa.
I haven't seen the other one was Jonathan Demme's Manchurian Candidate, which I haven't seen in about 10 years, but I remember being really good. But one I have seen recently is the 2011 Fright Night.
Oh, hey,
yeah.
Good choice.
Nice.
All right.
Oh, yeah. Shit.
I was
how
wondering
did I
how
not
this
think
is gonna
of that?
Be. I was wondering how this is going to be received because I love the first one. I mean,
yeah, first one's
right.
A classic.
You weren't on this podcast when Anton Yelchin died because we had a love fest over him, and I was like, "Fuck it, I love Fright Night, whatever."
Yeah.
Oh no,
yeah.
I didn't hear that one. Okay, oh. Well, I'm in good company.
Then. Yeah, you are.
I really think the remake is pretty good. Like, it falls into some like teeny bopper action comedy, like wish fulfillment shit, like especially with his neighbor, mm-hmm. But. I think it's really pretty smartly written. I mean, Colin Farrell, he's great. And almost as sexy as Chris Sarandon, which was pretty surprising.
That Colin Farrell's a sexy man?
No, as sexy as Chris Sarandon okay. from the original, though. Like,
just making sure.
They both exude quite a bit of sex appeal. So, yeah, I mean, David Tennant, especially in Roddy McDowell's role, like that movie's just really fun and very self-aware. And Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I don't have a lot to say about Fright Night because, to be honest, there's not, you know, a huge amount of substance there. But it's just, it's a testament to like a, you know, a low stakes but still pretty well written and pretty well acted action comedy that we don't really get that often anymore. I guess obviously you guys talked about Anton Yelchin there, and like, it's just, he's one of those actors that was very versatile, even when he was put into these roles where, you know, the movie was on his shoulders. I mean, he could play it very reliably.
It's also got Imogen Poots in it.
Yeah. And I didn't get to say Imogen Poots' name, which is obviously great. I love the Poots.
Good. This film was actually written by Marty Noxon, and
yeah.
I don't know if y'all know the background for her, but sure. She also served as a writer for Buffy the Vampire Slayer while it was kind of on the tail end in like the late 2000s or in the early 2000s. So
she's,
it was
also
right
the showrunner
after
of a Lifetime show called Unreal that was excellent in its first season.
Oh yeah, I heard good things about the first season of Unreal.
Second season, not so much. Not so much.
But, and yeah. she's not the executive producer on the second season.
Well,
she's
not. We go. Yeah. Marty Noxon, gotta get back on the chair.
Yeah, it looks like she's actually credited, but
if
you've listened
to, you know, it's like Dan Harmon got kicked off a Community, but he still got to keep his name on it because he made it.
Exactly. Yeah. So, okay. She's left that official role at least. Yeah. And yeah, she also wrote some for Mad Men as well.
Oh, really? Okay. Yep.
Do you know which episode? Is it The Crash?
It is The Gypsy and the Hobo, and it's The Inheritance.
Oh, okay.
Ooh.
So those were in 2008 and 2009.
All right, well, my remakes. First of all, again, we all shouted over who would get to talk about The Thing. But, you know, we got so many people who said The Thing. And so I don't think we need to, really.
Yeah.
So I then was like, well, what is one other remake that I liked? And I realized I was having trouble picking because I actually came up with two that I thought were super good, and I couldn't decide which one, so I'm going to say them both.
Uh-oh.
I'm going to say them both, and I'm still going to take less time than Bill did to talk about one. So,
oh, shit.
Sick burn on Bill. So
jeez.
My first choice is 310 to Yuma.
Nice.
By James Mangold. Christian Bale. And Russell Crowe. Michael, were you going to say
something? Hurry up.
Is Ben Foster in that one too?
Yes, he is.
Or am I misremembering? Yep. Okay.
In fact, I thought about this because I brought it up during Hell or High Water when we were talking about Ben Foster, because he's in that trailer running through saying, "This town's gonna burn!" And his delivery just in that trailer is amazing. So 310 to Yuma is a fantastic modern Western that balances its classical elements with its more modern style, and I think it does super well. Now, this may be a controversial choice just because I don't know how you two felt about this movie. It's the most recent American version of Godzilla.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm good with that.
All right, fine.
See, this is that one that was toeing that line, right? Because I mentioned this early on when we were talking about it, and I was like, is that a remake or is it a reimagination? Or
this, I would say, because Godzilla is a purely cinematic creation, that is a remake.
I'll go with that. Okay.
Yeah. So yeah.
Brian, I'd like to hear why you like Godzilla, though.
What?
I liked it too, but I'd love to hear what you liked about this version.
What I liked about this version was how unsentimental it was about humanity. I really do like how pointless the people are in this movie, because like, this is a problem in Roland Emmerich films. It's like, you have this one character that you're following and you're like, oh, thank God them and their dog survived, and then meanwhile, like, they're flying out of a city that is literally on fire and upside down. And this movie really gets to the core of like the diminished scale of people when put up against a 300-story lizard not 300 stories, let's say 300 feet. And it was just great to see that, like, to see a movie that, sure, it had human characters, but you could almost feel the movie's contempt for its need to have them.
So, and, what... Well, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, what was missing from the 90s Godzilla, I think it was 98, was, like, an interest in Godzilla, really. So,
sure, yeah.
What this movie is great with is how in awe of its monsters it is. And mm-hmm. in the way that it parcels out views of them and its restraint and its knowledge that, like, if you open with an orgy of violence where you see monsters pummeling at each other, that shit's going to get real old real fast. And sure. in this, you get little clips and little dibs and dabs here and there. So when it happens at the end, when it finally happens, you're, like, on the edge of your seat, and you're just like, yes, give it to me. Like, I cheered in this movie when the fire breath was finally used.
Yes.
Because,
yeah.
in, like, the age of Marvel films, like, that would be opening shot. And sure. then you'd just be like, okay, when is this guy going to use... When is he going to use the fire breath again? Or, like, they'd have to contrive a reason that he couldn't use it because they know they can't use it all the time. But in this, they're like, he's going to hold off. He's going to hold off until the last minute, and then he does it. God damn it. And then I love how it kind of brings in the weird emotional trajectory that the movies have had with Godzilla, because he started off as, like, an implacable, unstoppable monster, and then he became sort of like a champion of humanity.
Yeah.
And this movie...
He would defend us.
Yeah, it's like, oh, like, Godzilla will come and help us, and it's like, sure, he's knocking down a bunch of buildings, but, you know, it's... The George Bush effect. He's creating nothing but chaos and strife and anger, but God, he's got a good heart. So got weirdly political for a second. So
about George Godzilla, Bush too.
Yeah,
really topical show.
Hey-o. So no, there's something brilliant in the way that this movie, like, ends with, like, this great ambivalence towards him, because he's just a giant fucking animal. And they make a lot of points in the movie saying, like, they're just following their nature. Like, we can't direct this. We can try, and it sort of works. But humans in this movie just get pummeled and screwed over left and right. And, you know, you're going to have a movie named Godzilla. You don't want fucking Matthew Broderick running around trying to reconnect with an old girlfriend. Like, yeah. Godzilla is our emotional entry point. Godzilla is the one who we care about. And at the end, Godzilla is the one we cheer for.
I love how that movie, too, foreshadows its ballsiness, like, like, it makes a ballsy move within the first 30 minutes that absolutely foreshadow what you're talking about. It's like, oh, you wanted to get attached to all of these great actors who just happen to be in, like, the smallest roles in the world? Well, you know what? It's not really about them. Fuck you.
You came to a movie called Godzilla. Like, what? This is what you're getting, and you should be happy about it. And you should be, because it's amazing. And... The only reason that I feel any hope for Rogue One is because they share the director. Gareth Edwards.
I think that one looks great, actually.
Yeah, I really like the cast. I really like the crew. I don't know. Like everything about that film just...
Rogue One?
Rings. Yeah.
Right, but it's, I mean, you say you like the look of it, and I mean, like, that's because it's him.
It's the Zero Dark 30 DP.
I didn't say the look of it. I just said the casting
Michael
crew.
Said the look of it, and you said the casting crew. But I mean, that's he's the director. Like, before I saw a single frame of footage for Rogue One, I was like, you know what? It's got Gareth Edwards. Edwards, am I saying that right, or is it Evans?
Yeah, no, it's Edwards. Yeah, okay, Evans is
the raid
thing. It's got the right Gareth in it, and. It's just he's got a great sense of scale, and, like, you know, the old Japanese films, it was like, all right, well, we made this cardboard city and we've got this monster, so we've just got to pretend that this camera's, like, on a hilltop over here. And ever since computer generated special effects, like, we've just kind of lost our sense of scale, but this movie delivers that sense of scale, and you really feel how huge this thing is.
Oh, yeah. There's two sequences, really, that kind of key in on that. One is when they shoot up some flares and it moves in the background, and you're like, oh, that that wasn't even half as high.
Yeah, it's like, oh, it's his knee. Okay, yeah. Well, that's a problem.
And then the other part is obviously when they do the, what is it called? The halo drop.
Mm.
Yeah. And that sequence is, no matter how much CGI, like that that sequence is so much. Like,
it has stakes.
Well, but there's so much green screen in that, and yet you just don't give a shit. You're just like, right. Yeah, but they're going to jump on top of Godzilla. Like, this is going to be awesome.
No, I know. Exactly. I know exactly what you're talking about. I'm glad that I brought up Godzilla, because I don't think people talk enough about how good Godzilla is.
That was definitely
kept really positive. I'm really digging it.
It's funny. For all three of those movies that we picked, all right? Well, Brian, you picked another one, but so all three of those movies, I think pretty much everybody would be fair to say a lot of people were hesitant going into these films, right? Fright Night, Godzilla, and Dread. Like, a lot of people were like, oh God, you know, like another one of these things. And yet, they were really good. Like, yeah. And they didn't do as well. None of these films did as well as they should have.
None of them did. I agree. Yeah. Yep. And what's weird is no one else in our feedback, I think, brought up Godzilla. Let's find out. Let's play the feedback.
Uh-oh.
All right, everybody brace
yourselves. Round robin.
It's Rockin' Robin.
Oh, come on. Rockin' Robin, then.
Round robin. Anyway.
Sorry, Jordan.
There's a factual error. Okay. Tweets. We have Tyler, who said, I found the Rob Zombie Halloween movies to be interesting and memorable, even if I don't think they're great, and for some reason the first ones I thought of, so that must count for something. Mike Mazzantini. Mazzanti? Mike Mazzanti says, John Carpenter's The Thing remake, the 1951 version, obviously not the weird sequel remake thing from 2011. Rapscallion says John Carpenter's The Thing. Matt Supps says The Thing. Ryan Tallarico says Invasion of the Body Snatchers. The Fly, The Thing. There's a trend here. Liberty says Philip Kaufman's Invasion of the Body Snatchers. Rodolfo Claros says Casino Royale for sure. The original with Woody Allen is so bad. Rob Bickmore says The Thomas Crown Affair immediately comes to mind, and I agree. John Dewar, Solaris. Tony Hines said Cronenberg's The Fly, Herzog's Nosferatu, which is on Mubi now. Also, Casey says Invasion of the Body Snatchers and Ocean's 11, which is a great choice that I didn't even think of. Dan says The Wicker Man, Nick Cage proving the value a remake can bring. Christopher Parks says True Grit. Jordan Raup, our benevolent Lord and Master, says Vanilla Sky, The Departed, Funny Games, Cape Fear, True Lies, and Heat, if it counts. Charlie Nash, still think The Ring holds up great, even after seeing Ringu. Gord Verbinski's own gothic style oozes with dread. Then later he tweeted, you know what, fuck it, I actually like The Ring more than Ringu, and I'm not even ashamed to admit it. Wear that pin proud, Charlie. Matt Sips, said The Thing. I'm sorry, I already said that one. Let's go to Facebook then. Jonathan Sullivan, off the top of my head, Let Me In. I'm sure there's better than that, though. So I don't know why he didn't take 4 minutes and think about it. Kai Parker says The Thing. Again, Magnificent Seven, which is of Seven Samurai, not the most recent one. And then he said Batman Begins, and we argued for 3 days on Facebook about what is a reboot and what is a sequel. And he is wrong. Eric Marshall Maine.
Not quite it.
No. Eric Marshall Maine. I really liked Evil Dead. I haven't seen it, but I'm sure Scarface should go on here, too.
I actually liked Evil Dead a lot.
Ben Popick says The Karate Kid with my man J-Dog. Ben Johannes.
That one's not bad.
Says 310 to Yuma, hell yeah. Nick Russo says there are surely better ones, but True Grit comes to mind. Angelo Thomas, I really thought we were going to get through in a single Rockin' Robin. That sucks. Here we go. Start it over again. We only have a couple more. Angelo Thomas says Charlie and the Chocolate Factory or The Wizard of Oz, because some people consider that a remake. Although both are adaptations of books rather than just remakes of existing movies, so asterisk, shrug, asterisk.
What?
And then Ryan Green Skittles says, The Departed. Does it fit your criteria? Maybe yes, maybe no, maybe fuck yourself. Thank you, Ryan, for incorporating that quote in. That is amazing. So that is that. We did it.
Yeah.
Didn't get as many responses. I think this is a harder one to fit in because, there's a lot of remakes out there, and some people are just like, you know what? I don't want to give any love to remakes.
That is true. That's true.
You won't give love to remakes. Remakes are terrible. But as we've just proven, that's not true. So
and it is.
Sully is out in theaters now, and it actually made a lot of money this weekend. And it is not a remake. It is an adaptation of a real-life event that happened. Someone on Twitter, I think it was... I'm not going to say who I think it was, because I'm probably wrong. Someone on Twitter called them Boats Movies, which is based on a true story, which is a cute acronym. Especially if you apply it to Captain Phillips, because that is a Boats movie that took place on a boat. But anyway...
I'm the captain now.
I am the captain now. So that's what this next topic is. A true story worth telling.
The legend lives on from the Chippewa on down of the big lake they call Gitche-Gumee. The lake, it is said, never gives up her dead when the skies of November turn gloomy.
Speaking of boats, that is Gordon Lightfoot singing The Wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald. And I didn't actually just choose that because it's a boat. In fact, that was a completely new connection to me. Instead, what we are going to talk about right now are true life events that we would like to see adapted into movies. Because this is a thing that Hollywood does a lot. We've got a bunch coming out, actually. We just had Sully. We're going to have one about the Boston Marathon bombing. We are going to have one about the Deep Sea Horizon.
Deep Water
Horizon, Deep Sea Drilling Operation. I think both of those are Marky Mark, aren't they?
Yeah. I think they're both Peter Berg, actually.
No, Jesus. Well, how about that?
Wow.
I was about to say, he also did Lone Survivor recently. Yeah. Anyway, American Sniper, things like that. These are movies that are based on a true story, or my favorite, inspired by true events. So we know that these things get made all the time. What we wanted to do was pitch our own films that are based on a true story. So that's what we're going to do. Gentlemen, I hope you brought some really good shit with you. Well, that's
I'm fine with this.
All right. We started off with Bill last time. Let's start off with Michael Snydell.
Well, guys, it's hard to remember stories I've read in the last few years, but I started thinking about it, and weirdly, one of the first ones that came to me was a GQ feature called The Strange and Curious Tale of the Last True Hermit. So this was about Christopher Thomas Knight, who lived in the woods of Maine for 27 years. When he was like 20, he just went into the woods one day and lived out there, and he survived by committing almost 1,000 burglaries of random houses around the woods. And, you know, he would steal food and, you know, like toiletries and all kinds of things. And he survived just by doing that. But the profile was all about, obviously, when he gets caught, he was sent to jail for 7 months when someone, when they finally found him, which I'm forgetting how that happened, but he was captured during a burglary in 2013, and he served 7 months. And so the feature is about the writer just talking to him in jail, and it's a fascinating piece of writing on its own. The writer is Michael Finkel, and it's an interesting story in the sense of survival and things like that. But where I think it would especially be I'm not going to use a word like Oscar or anything, you know, Oscar bait or anything like that. But this did be a very meaty performance for whoever did it, because some of the most interesting parts of the feature are about him learning human emotions and learning how to respond to people, and like the difficulty of learning to smile. And so like this, this feature just has all of these really interesting details along those lines. So, you know, I thought, I think somebody could make a pretty good movie out of this. I couldn't think of any particular directors, but
I was gonna
do you guys have any ideas?
That's a difficult one. I'm trying to think of, I mean, J.C. Chandor, you know.
Yeah.
He'd be good. I'd be down with that. I'm trying to think of who, what other like directors kind of have like a singular or like a really
strong. I could see Kelly Reichardt doing this.
Oh, yeah, that'd be good, actually. Huh. Who would you want him to play, though? Who would you want to play him?
Oh, jeez. I don't know.
How old were they when they were taken in? Do you recall?
I think he... he's almost 50.
I was going to say Richard Jenkins, but I think he's too old.
You know, I don't know.
I don't know. I don't have any...
I love your contributions, Bill.
Bill is like, what? All right. Well, Bill... Let's see what you brought to the table. What is your true life story that you would love to see adapted into a film?
So I came at this more from what I would actually like to see adapted. I would struggle to try and put some of these things together, because I think some of these things are not necessarily inherently cinematic. But okay. I think they make extremely good stories that someone that has that kind of keen eye for what is cinema and what is easily adapted and what should be made will, you know, work it out. But look, I listen to a lot of podcasts, and there's been a few that I've really kind of hit recently that I found fascinating. The first one is actually from April 2013, and it is, if anybody listens to podcasts, more than likely, even if you haven't listened to podcasts, more than likely you've heard of this show called Serial by Sarah Koenig.
Yep.
And the original reason that story started was actually because of this story. And this story was on This American Life, and it was called Dr. Gilmer and Mr. Hyde. And basically the setup of the story is that Dr. Benjamin Gilmer happens to take over a practice, dental practice, about another Dr. Gilmer, all right? Yeah. The previous Dr. Gilmer brutally murdered his father and is sitting in jail. And the new Dr. Gilmer is taking over the practice and keeps being told about how great the former Dr. Gilmer was, and how he was just this beloved guy in this small community, and just a really, really loved guy. And how he really kind of fell down the spiral. And the story just continues to evolve from there. I don't want to give too much away. Obviously, I kind of want to sell the story. But I think the more you give away, the more it kind of reveals what is actually going on in this story. And I think that's kind of best left to, because look, if you've listened to Sarah Koenig on the first season of Serial, she does a fantastic job of selling that story, right? Mm-hmm. And I don't want to rob any listeners from being able to listen to this two-part. It's two parts, and I think it's about
an hour and a half.
Yeah, it's about an hour total. So, I mean,
it is really,
really
good.
it is fantastic. It is riveting storytelling. It is some of the stuff that if you've never really gotten into a podcast, this is the way to get into it.
Wait a second. If these people aren't into a podcast, what the fuck are they doing listening to this?
Whatever. Maybe you don't listen to real life podcasts, right? Maybe right, you listen to a lot of
guys. Yeah, I've heard a lot of This American Life, and I don't think I've heard this one actually. Really? So I'm really looking forward to listening to it.
Yeah, you know what we should do? I want you each to send me links to these things, and we can post them on the sure. Film Stage Show page so people can check these out.
So sure. The other one that I want to kind of bring up real quick, because I don't really have a lot of casting ideas for that or things like that, but the other one that I want to bring up is actually called Playing God, and this was on Radiolab recently. And this was basically about what happened during Hurricane Katrina in the main hospital in New Orleans. And basically what they had a situation where I think the storm hit on like a Tuesday. Wednesday, the water level, the levees broke, right? Tuesday or Wednesday, the floodwaters rose. It rose so high that it actually started shorting out some of the equipment, so they were without power. By Thursday, they didn't have any power, and it was like 110 degrees inside the actual place, right? It was crazy hot. They were running out of water. Sewage was starting to back up, and the helicopters that were frequently landing on top where they evacuated all the babies and really, really sick people, those helicopters stopped coming around, and they were listening to the news, and the news was talking about how people were acting like zombies. They were breaking into buildings. They were, the National Guard was called in, and there was supposedly like a martial law was called, and all of this crazy hyperbole was happening on the radios, and that was their only form of communication. Obviously the cell phone networks down there were just smashed. And any kind of radio communication was pretty much non-existent at this point. So they literally thought they were basically looking at the end of the world, right? I mean, for what the situation they were in, and what they had to do was they started to have to do triage in how they cared for patients, how they moved patients, because they also had like four or five stories that they had to get up and down from, and they didn't have elevators. And some of these patients weighed a lot. They had equipment with them, so they couldn't take them up the stairs. So they literally broke through a wall to get to a parking garage that was attached to the building to then wheel people up to the top story to figure out, okay, I guess no helicopters are coming today. And apparently they started to maybe dose people with a high amount of morphine to just let them pass away instead of having to suffer through a lot of this stuff. And
wow.
This, I mean,
brutal.
It is like listening to it, listening to the setup, listening to kind of the execution. And this story is she's a reporter from the New York Times, and she – let's see here. Let me see. Sherry Fink is her name, and she's a reporter for the New York Times, and she did the story in collaboration with Radiolab. And the main piece was about Hurricane Katrina, but it was basically about how she moved from like two or three different locations, and she kept on seeing this triage precaution kind of taken. And it's all about like what do you do in these situations that are so harrowing that you have to make these kind of tough decisions about, look, we only have so many staff to help these people. How do we help everybody? We can't. So we have to help the people that are most likely to survive. right? Like, isn't that the answer? Or is it, do we help the people that most need our help? Or do we try and just say, you're not going to be able to be saved? You would cost too much resource to be, you know, to be any good. So we're going to just make sure that the people that we think can survive can survive. And so it's these tough stories. And yeah, the one about Hurricane Katrina, I think it's about a 20-30 minute kind of segment piece. And it's the main piece of this particular podcast. And it was just the way that they kind of built up this landscape and what was going on. I never realized how much of a hellscape that, I mean, can you imagine if you couldn't call anyone, you couldn't talk to the outside world, you were stuck, and all you heard on the radio reports were all this chaos going around you. Yeah, you would have, and remember, this happened Tuesday, the storm hit. Wednesday, the floods rose. Thursday, they started, you know, maybe thinking about killing people. I mean, it was that quick that just all of just like, you know, this built up kind of community and this worldliness that we have, man, when shit hits the fan, some of that just goes away. And it's crazy. It's crazy.
All right. Yep. Well, that's all the time we have for today. I'm not 100% joking. We're at 58 minutes right now. So,
I director idea for that one.
Yeah, I don't know.
So
Catherine Bigelow.
I had
to say Michael Steve McQueen. I mean, I almost said Michael McQueen. Steve McQueen.
So I had two. I don't think we have time to go into one of them. And I don't think that we have time for me to do justice to the other.
Well, you got to mention them. are they based on quick stories, or are they based on like podcasts? What are they based on?
They're based on real life. Like, they're real life stories. That was what we were talking about.
They're based on your life, Brian?
No, they're not based on my life. I made that an explicit thing. I said we couldn't base it on our own lives. I don't know. I really wanted to talk about this one, but we definitely don't have time for it. So, there's a New Yorker article called The Fire Eaters, and it is by Lauren Collins. It was in the November 4th, 2013 issue, and it is about people who grow their own strains of chili peppers and the race to create the hottest chili pepper.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, so it's, I don't know how you would play this. I guess it would sort of...
Christopher Guest.
I was about to say, like, a Christopher Guest-style thing would be hilarious. Because it's just these real... It's like these, you know, the type of guy who devotes his life to growing super hots, which is what they call the chilies, is just, like, they're crazy. I think... what is it? It's the Carolina Reaper is the one that's, like... It's supposedly the hottest on Earth, but it hasn't been certified. And so there's like this whole giant thing about is it
because
really...
the other one is ghost pepper, right?
No, that's like... way down on the scale.
Oh, Jesus.
There's like the Trinidad Scorpion Butch Tea, the Trinidad Morga Scorpion, the Jonah Seven Pots. I mean, like,
let me ask you this, since you read the article and you kind of seem
I've read this
a little
article three
bit...
times since it came out. Okay. Cause it's just that fun to read.
Let me ask you this. Is the hotness a natural defense? What is the mechanism of the heat?
It's presumed to be a natural defense against eating.
Okay.
But the thing is that when you eat it, it releases chemicals in your brain that make you love it if you're a certain kind of person.
Oh.
So I would love to be able to go into what the Scoville scale is. But this... Okay, so the Scoville scale is basically how much water, I think sugar water, does it take to, like, bring down the heat of something?
Oh, wow.
So... They do everything by Scoville. And the Boot Jalokia, which is, I believe, the ghost pepper bill that you were talking about, is 462,400 Scoville units. Is that right?
Wow.
You got to shorten that number.
And, oh, no, no. No, that's actually not what it is. All right, so I don't know what that is, but let me just tell you that the scorpion that this guy, or the Carolina Reaper that this guy, Ed Curry, created, he believes that it is close, just shy, of 1.5 million Scoville units.
Jesus.
Wow. Yeah.
Why would you eat that?
I don't know. What is wrong with people?
They want
to literally take a normal, natural, healthy human being and give them heartburn in 1 minute. Here's heartburn for your entire life. Eat this.
A habanero is between 100,000 and 350,000, depending.
Right. Is a habanero. To make you see a coyote who sounds like Johnny Cash.
The Guatemalan insanity peppers.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if they're not, I mean, I don't really care what Scoville.
So that's my super simple choice. I think that the story of these people doing this crazy thing, and then them fighting over who actually has the hottest, because if you read the article, they go into like, well, you have to prove that the strain is stable, and then you have to certify it with a certain people, and they take like a mean instead of like the most hot that you can do. So if you give them like 5 peppers, they average them all together. So one of them could be super hot when technically the hottest, but it doesn't count. So it's like a weird convergence of sports, politics, and guys making peppers.
I'm skimming this, and this is crazy, Brian.
Yeah. So once again, we're going to post links to all of these stories when we post this. So go to thefilmstage.com and find this, and it'll be some good reads and listens for you. And you can yourself imagine what the fuck these would be like. So that's it. That's all for today. We have to do something where I can talk about my other one, because it's awesome and crazy. And I don't think enough people know about the story, and I'm super passionate about it. And I'm sad that we didn't have enough time.
Can Peter Berg direct it?
No. No. Which is sad, because we could get it made if Peter Berg could, because Peter Berg can get anything made. We don't have any feedback for this, so that's good. So let's just get the fuck out of here. I hope you all have enjoyed the roundtable today. Let's talk about Mubi real quick before we leave. Everybody knows how much we love Mubi. And again, one guy said Werner Herzog's Nosferatu is one of the best remakes of all time. That was on Mubi, guys. It's there. For now, I don't know if it's going to be there much longer. You got to get on Mubi and find out.
Aren't we going to vote to watch a movie from Mubi as well?
a Mubi. Here's what I think.
A Mubi movie.
We're going to post a poll
from Mubi.
I think that we each independently should choose one film, and then we'll just create a Twitter poll.
Okay.
So we're going to do that. You're listening to this probably on Friday. By Saturday, this poll will be closed, and we will watch a movie from Mubi and talk about it briefly before talking about The Blair Witch. So, get on that. Go get your free month trial of Mubi by going to mubi.com/filmstage and be part of the conversation. Mubi. Tagline pending. So, that's it for today. That's all. Let us know what you thought of our crazy thoughts and opinions by finding us on iTunes and giving us a comment and a rating and a subscription, reaching out on Twitter at Film Stage Show or Facebook by searching The Film Stage Show, and of course by going to thefilmstage.com and commenting on this episode's page. If you have any ideas for topics you want to hear about, become a Pulitzer Prize winning journalist of some kind and either make a podcast or write an article about them, and then we will adapt those into a podcast. Or you can just use those previously mentioned methods. Speaking of contacting us and reaching out, let's tell the fine people at home where we could be found between now and the next time. Bill Graham.
You can find me writing about movies on the Film Stage and also freshfiction.tv. And you can also find me listening to podcasts on Twitter. Don't interrupt me.
Not a thing. You can't do that.
At Cable BFG.
Did you know that you can watch Thursday Night Football on Twitter now?
I heard I can also watch Atlanta, the new
on Twitter.
On Facebook.
Oh, crazy! Really? You know what you can't do though. You can't listen to a podcast on Twitter, Bill.
You can try. I'm gonna try.
Michael Snydell, where can we find you online?
You can read things I've written at Film Stage and Pace Magazine. This week, I have an interview with the Operation Avalanche director Matt Johnson, and a review of the new Steve James Tiff documentary, Abacus. And you can also find me being the world's worst hermit at twitter.com at Snydell.
Truly the world's worst hermit would have a Twitter page. I'm Brian J. Rowan. You can find me on Twitter at Brian J. Rowan, Letterboxd at Brian J. Rowan, Instagram at Brian J. Rowan. Peach, is that still a thing? Who knows? I also have a review of The Vessel up on the Film Stage, so go there, look at that, it's awesome. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us, and tune in next time.